Oprah's been talking about this since 2013, and I have to say, what I can tell you is that from my perspective as chief executive of Love British Food, and my aim, particularly in the public sector, to get more British food on public sector menus, I do not see the government as being a particularly useful driver in achieving that, in all honesty.
Food campaigner Alexia Robinson says the government could be working harder to get more British food on more British plates. We take a special look at the fertiliser market, and applications are open for a bursary that will pay university fees for farm students. Welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. I'm Johan Tasker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
All that and more coming up, including the latest commodity prices. But first, our top story. Hopes have been raised of a possible change to government plans to impose inheritance tax on farmers, with the Treasury said to be considering alternative proposals that could be easier on farming families. Conversations are said to be taking place across Whitehall, with senior civil servants reported to be looking at a minimum share rule which would take smaller farms out of the equation when it comes to paying inheritance tax. Well, to discuss and explain all the latest developments, we're joined by Farmers Weekly's Phil Case, who's been working on this story with Farmers Weekly deputy editor Abby Kay. Phil, I think before we go any further, it's important that we don't over-egg this. I don't want to give listeners false hope, but I think it's important that we acknowledge that something is happening here, and we have been told there's a possibility of a shift in this proposed policy.
Yes, we have, Johan, and there certainly seems to be a bit of a movement in terms of the positivity that that the farm leaders are telling us about at the moment. They're telling us that rural MPs, in particular Labour MPs, are more open. They are listening to their concerns. But what is not clear yet is whether or not that is having an impact on the party leadership itself.
Well, Phil, I don't want to give listeners false hope here. I think that would be completely wrong and unfair. But what has the Treasury said?
The Treasury, when we did contact the Treasury on Wednesday during our press deadline, they told us that they do not comment on speculation. However, what was a bit different this time round was that they spent several hours before they got back to us with a response. Usually they would call us straight away and frankly pour cold water on the story. But this time round, I actually had to press the press office, or I had to contact the press office again after 3 o'clock and ask them for the statement. So they then responded with a previous written statement from September, which said that basically the government was happy with its position, and it felt that it was a fair compromise both for the public and for farmers in terms of the finances. But clearly there is a bit of a momentum shift, and there's some curious things that may be going on in behind the scenes.
And you say curious things, you mean they're looking again at this Sentax report, which has suggested a different way of implementing these inheritance tax plans?
Yes, indeed. So the Sentax report looks at raising the IHT threshold. So that would mean that a lot of the smaller sort of family farms would not be caught by this new taxation, which means they would be free and they would be exempt still from inheritance tax. However, if we talk to the likes of Farms to Action, they are still adamant that they want inheritance tax completely abolished in all of its forms. And they say that that is the only fair outcome, and that if they do increase the threshold, it will only really be making a bad policy marginally better for farmers.
So some industry leaders willing to accept a compromise on inheritance tax, but the Farmers to Action group pledging another round of protests unless the government performs a complete U-turn.
Yes, well, this is the situation at the moment with Farmers to Action. They're still very upset about the whole situation, and they're saying that the government can expect a winter of discontent that hasn't been seen since the late 70s, when I was a very small boy, shall we say, a toddler. So they can expect a round of, or a new wave of protests, and it will take the form of protests across the country. It'll be more of a coordinated action in larger cities, and it would be tractor go slow runs rather than static protests. So yes, there is this prospect in the background of further protests, but of course it much depends on the government. If the government does announce that it's going to move and it's going to make some changes to the IHT policy, then I think that thread of protests will go away.
Phil Case, Farmers Weekly chief reporter, thank you. Now, inheritance tax was also a hot topic at this week's Conservative Party conference, where Abby Kaye caught up with Shadow Farm Minister Robbie Moore, who said Labour MPs were increasingly willing to discuss the issue.
To be fair to some of the rural Labour MPs, there is a willingness to understand the complexities within the farming industry and the complexities within the wider supply chain. Of course there are. All MPs should have that level of curiosity. And I know that some of them have been meeting with their farming constituents and wider industry representatives. But that's just not good enough to meet, right? They've got to be taking that voice to the decision makers and voting accordingly with the level of concern that's been raised. But, you know, I am absolutely doing as much outreach as well with some of those Labour rural MPs. And we all talk in the corridors. We all are colleagues of one another's. You know, when you sit on a select committee, you are operating as a cross-party committee to try and influence and help the government do the right thing. So behind, you know, the sometimes what seems as a bit of a theatre of the chamber, the House of Commons chamber, there is a lot of conversations that are going on. And those new MPs that have now been in Parliament for a year wanting to understand, well, how does this bizarre parliamentary system work in trying to influence change? The reality of it is, though, is that the government has such a huge majority. If every Conservative MP, Liberal Democrat MP, Reform, Green, Independent, all of us on those opposition benches voted together on every single issue for the next 4 years before the next general election, we're going to lose every single vote. And even if, you know, 50 of those Labour MPs joined us on a particular issue, we're going to lose every single vote. That is the scale of the power that this Prime Minister has in the Labour Party. That's why being in opposition is incredibly frustrating and challenging at times, because politics is about numbers.
Our Shadow Farm Minister Robbie Moore talking to Abby Kaye, who's with us now on the line. Abby, Labour and Conservative MPs trying then to find a way forward on inheritance tax.
Yeah, that's right. And I actually think that's a really good thing. You know, politics in the UK, specifically Westminster, actually, less so in the devolved nations. But in Westminster, it's so tribal, isn't it, and adversarial, that that can actually be detrimental to policy making. You know, if one party's got a good policy, the other party has to disagree just because they're a different party. And they're always trying to set kind of procedural traps for each other. And that just doesn't translate well to the ordinary person on the street. Let me give you an example. So you'd have something like opposition day debates, where the opposition party gets to choose kind of the topic of debate and they can force a vote on the motion at the end of the debate. But the government will 9 times out of 10 whip MPs to vote against the motion just because it's been proposed by the opposition, regardless of the merit of the argument and whether or not they agree. And if they do, they'll just find another way to show their support for the issue. So it was really nice to hear Robbie say that and to know that those MPs are kind of working in a collaborative cross-party way behind closed doors. But I do think the fact that those conversations are taking place, it does say something about morale in the Labour Party, I think. It's got to be pretty low because MPs are kind of riding on high and they feel comfortable with the direction of travel in the party and they feel listened to by the leadership. I don't personally think they would be looking for advice or counsel outside of the party if they felt that way. And that's certainly something that I'm hearing again and again is, you know, a lot of the rural contingent of Labour MPs feel abandoned, and Labour HQ have effectively written off their seats and decided, well, we're not going to win them at the next election anyway, so we'll hang you out to dry. That's a kind of perception that I've picked up time and time again.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And now a special word with this week's podcast partner, NFU Mutual, and I'm joined by NFU Mutual's Rosie Monk. Rosie, NFU Mutual, not just about insurance, you offer a range of services to farmers.
Yeah, so NFU Mutual offers a wide range of products and services. Our local NFU Mutual agents work closely with farmers and really understand the day-to-day challenges you face. And because they're both based in your community, they're always nearby to offer friendly personal support. The NFU Mutual team do more than just help farmers insure rural properties, vehicles and livestock. We also have expert financial advisors across the UK who are well-versed in the needs of farming businesses, and they're able to support with things like inheritance tax planning and making the most of available reliefs. They can advise on a wide range of NFU Mutual products and others we offer from specialist providers, and they'll take time to explain the services we offer and the charges so that everything's clear from the start. And finally, when it comes to health and safety, we've got NFU Mutual Risk Management Services with specialist consultants who will go out and visit farms to offer practical advice and support.
There's lots of different insurance companies out there, but what makes NFU Mutual different to other insurers?
Yeah, so there's a lot that makes NFU Mutual stand out from other insurers. For starters, our heritage. We were founded by farmers for farmers, and we've been supporting the industry for over 115 years now. So that means we really get farming and the challenges that come with it. We keep things simple and transparent, so there's no admin fees for making changes to your policy and no extra charges for paying monthly by direct debit. We also work closely with farming unions to make sure farmers' interests are front and centre when it comes to industry development. And we also offer mutual bonus, rewarding loyalty and giving customers a saving on the renewal premium of their general insurance policies. But it's not all about the products and services we offer. Beyond insurance, we're committed to supporting the farming community through initiatives that reflect your values and protect your way of life, from educating young farmers and promoting farm safety to tackling rural poverty. We're proud to play a part. In 2024 alone, we donated £3.25 million to causes across the UK and invested over £440,000 to help fight rural crime and support local communities.
So a strong pedigree then, lots of heritage. How are you adapting at NFU Mutual to support farmers in the modern day?
We're always looking ahead at NFU Mutual to make sure our cover keeps up with the way farming is evolving. That means ensuring new tech like automated machinery and developing innovative products like parametric insurance that is triggered by weather events, not just claims. We're also exploring how we can develop offerings to support natural capital projects so farmers can make the most of opportunities in this growing area.
And Rosie, how can farmers get hold of NFU Mutual?
NFU Mutual have over 280 local agency offices across the UK, which means we are always close by. Whether you want to give them a call, send them an email or pop in for a chat, your local office is there ready to help you. You can easily find their contact details by heading to nfumutual.co.uk.
Rosie Monk from NFU Mutual, this week's Farmers Weekly podcast partner. Thank you very much.
The Farmers Weekly podcast.
Now, 6 months ago, the government said it wanted half of all public sector food to come from British farms or those certified to higher environmental standards. Well, what better time for a progress report than during British Food Fortnight, the annual national celebration of UK food and farming. Public sector catering contracts are worth about £5 billion annually, and half of that would be a huge boost for British farmers. I asked British Food Fortnight organiser Alexia Robinson whether the government was doing enough to help schools, hospitals and indeed local councils buy more British food.
Well, do you know, the DEFRA has been talking about this since 2013. And I have to say, for the last few years, you know, I honestly have not really, I haven't really paid that much attention to it. I mean, you know, hooray, Keir Starmer stands up at the NFU conference and makes sweeping statements about 50% British sourcing in the public sector. I actually think Steve Reid was quite sensible to say, right, as step one in this, we're actually going to conduct an assessment of how much British food is actually purchased across the public sector. Because I can tell you, by the time you've looked at dairy and bread, you've probably hit about 50%. So I think that statistic, it made headlines, but when you actually start talking to a company like Sodexo or something, who will say, look, we're buying probably 80% British in that sector already. You need to, what's far more worthwhile is to start to look at what council catering services responsible for school meals are doing, what NHS catering teams are doing in NHS trusts.
And what are they doing, Alexia? Can you give me some numbers?
I can't give you stats and things on that, but what I can tell you is that from my perspective as chief executive of Love British Food, and my aim particularly in the public sector to get more British food on public sector menus, I do not see the government as being a particularly useful driver in achieving that, in all honesty. And thank goodness that I do conclude that, given that it's sat on DEFRA's table gathering dust since 2013. So, you know, don't hold your breath on it. But I don't want to be dismissive. I mean, of course, with everything, you need government policy, but you need to drive these things from the bottom. And that's where I am deeply proud of the work that Love British Food has done. And not exclusively, I hasten to add. I mean, there are many, many organisations across the country doing wonderful things, either at a national level or at a local level, to achieve this. But I think what Love British Food has done is a number of things. First of all, it has put the Love British Food and British Food Fortnight promotions absolutely centre stage across the public sector. That's school catering, hospital catering, care home catering, university. It's established. I have been the longest serving member of the Public Sector Catering Alliance, and for a long time was the only person representing food and farming on that alliance, which has given us a really powerful voice. But most rewardingly of all, I've put in place a national programme of on-farm training days for public sector caterers, which we've run over the last few years. And we've now led 241 caterers through those training days. And each one of those people I would now describe as an empowered change maker who is back in their community, whether they are in a council catering service serving schools, or whether they are in an NHS trust setting or a care home setting, to use but a few examples. And they have left those on-farm training days with a real understanding of what buying British means. When you say to people, come on, buy British, you know, 50% on your menus, why? And they go away from those days and they really understand that they have a set of objectives back on their desk, you know, with sustainability, achieving net zero. I mean, lots of terms that some of your listeners may not like. I mean, the net zero term I balk at hugely. But when you can start to show them that buying British helps them achieve those targets, as well as really helping them to understand the connection between how food is produced, its nutritional value, the impact of how it's produced on the beautiful countryside that we all care about, and how that can contribute to the health of the people that they are serving, whether they are children, the elderly, patients, students. It is incredibly powerful. So what can government do? I mean, some government policy on that, particularly, I think, to shake up those councils who continue to pursue the ludicrous anti-meat agenda. I think a government lead on that in particular would be very helpful. But most of all, I'd like government to recognise the work of organisations like Love British Food, who are actually getting, you know, starting to actually get into catering teams, into communities, and look at what needs to be done to achieve a change in how they procure our food and prioritising British within that. It's quite gritty work, but that's where you achieve results.
Alexia, there's a lot of interest out there in British food, not just in the countryside, but in towns and cities too. You're also hosting a National Harvest Festival service on the 16th of October at Westminster Abbey.
Well, I mean, that couldn't be more timely this year. I mean, if ever there was a year for giving thanks to our farmers in that most traditional sense that we have done for you know, centuries through Harvest Festival, and indeed societies around the world gather together to celebrate the harvest and give thanks for the food produced. But this year it does feel deeply pertinent, and I'm particularly thrilled that there will be the president of the NFU will be leading the harvest torch in the offertory procession. But two former presidents Peter Kendall and Murig Raymond are both coming along to support, as is Stuart Roberts, who used to be deputy president, and indeed leaders from all the major farming organisations will be there. But there's a particularly important focus to this year's National Harvest Service, acknowledging that though we are so lucky to live in this wonderful country with our varied topography, our four seasons, you know, bountiful food produced to, you know, world-leading standards, there are many, many people in our society who do not have enough to eat and who go hungry. And so Love British Food has teamed up with some of the biggest food redistribution charities, Trussell, the Felix Project, City Harvest, and the Coronation Food Project, to thank those volunteers who work in redistributing food to those in need, to those volunteers who run food banks, and to gather and pray that food hunger and food poverty will be alleviated in the future. So it's going to be a glorious celebration of our farmers, a wonderful time to give thanks to those volunteers, and I can't wait. It's going to be completely magnificent.
That's Alexia Robinson from British Food Fortnight. Well, we also asked DEFRA what progress had been made on the government's ambition to source 50% of public sector food from British farmers. And it told us the government is firmly committed to supporting our farmers. Food security is national security. And DEFRA added, we've simplified the procurement process for government contracts to favour high environmental standards, which British producers are well placed to meet. We've also removed bureaucratic rules and regulations to open up new opportunities to small businesses. So Hugh, DEFRA saying it's made it easier for farmers to supply the public sector, but the government could still do a lot better. So says Alexia Robinson.
It totally could do a lot better. Look, public procurement statements are a bit like Tory policy being talked about at the moment, 4 years from an election. And public procurement stuff, particularly around food, it's a great snappy title. You know, if you're in a room with your prospective farming minister ahead of the election, as they were last year, and your SPAD saying, oh, what can we put in there? Well, we could talk about keeping this going. Oh, yeah, talk about public procurement, because they always talk about public procurement. And you can stand up and say, we will buy X billion of this, that, and the other. And you've got a total get-out-of-jail card, because then at the end of it, it's basically all utter BS, right? Because at the end of it, the army doesn't buy its own food. It goes to one of the big catering outfits, Initial, or whoever, one of the big, you know, facilities management catering suppliers, or the NHS or whoever. And ultimately, they win on the contract. Now, you can, the one thing that you can could do is put in really rigorous targets that, you know, yes, you can all bid for this contract to feed this hospital, but you've got to have at least 80% English Brussels sprouts in every meal, or something like that. But no one's going to put that in there because they're just not going to get anyone bid for the tender. So I'm afraid, yeah, it's really frustrating. It's really annoying. But ultimately, it comes down to cost. And it comes down, there's lots of reasons why it doesn't happen. And it's always one that's really easy for ministers to wriggle out of, because ultimately they can say, well, you know, at the point we award the tender, it becomes a commercial decision. We can't get involved.
And Louise, your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are probably very, very similar to Hugh's. I mean, there is a compromise or a trade-off here, isn't there? You know, we talk about the food that's produced in this country being of the highest standard and very, very good quality. And then, you know, the tenders for some of these contracts are so tight and so tricky to meet that they're substituting horrible, much cheaper ingredients. And yeah, that's a problem, isn't it? We don't particularly want our food to be sold at these very, very low prices. I mean, that's an issue, isn't it, at the moment for the industry. And yet it does seem a bit ridiculous that we're not supplying a lot of these institutions. And I don't actually know what the answer is. And I think you probably summed it up a lot better than I did. But it's a shame and it's a waste. And as he said, we hear always from ministers these announcements about how they're going to change this. But we haven't seen it changed yet. We can live in hope.
The big problem, though, is the tender. It's the way the tenders are designed, isn't it? Henry Dimbleby, bless him, he talked about this. He talked about this in his Feeding the Nation report 5 years ago. We touched upon it when we spoke to him at Groundswell, you'll remember. And this is actually a really great opportunity for governments to pick up, particularly for things like school meals. I mean, geez, it was 20-odd years ago that Jamie Oliver was on the Turkey Twizzlers campaign, and it made fantastic TV, didn't it? Oh, look, we're taking all these kids in East London, and we were feeding on this revolting gloop out of the bottom end of a turkey factory. And look, now we're feeding them lots of lovely veg and they're all getting busy and cooking stuff. And it lasted for like, you know, a year and a bit, and then the budget ran out and they went back to buying the gloop out the bottom end of the factory, because there's nothing in the contract that says you will stop feeding them that UPF and you'll start feeding them proper stuff. So that's the opportunity for government to do it. And as opposed to trying to do it for the whole of public procurement and say, everything's got to come from an English farm or whatever. Perhaps what they should do is really knuckle down a lot harder on some of these school diets and just make proper meals. You know, forget the meat-free Mondays and all that utter rubbish. Just make proper meals, have the vegan option, the vegetarian option, and use proper ingredients. But of course, that also has another nightmare scenario for managers and people trying to run things, because it requires a whole new skill set in all of these kitchens to be able to cook all this proper food, which for most big commercial rock bottom price kitchens, that skill set just doesn't exist.
And yet so many people across the country say it's important where the food comes from, not just during British Food Fortnight, which has been a roaring success again this year, but this National Harvest Festival being held at Westminster Abbey, central London, completely sold out, no tickets available. There's huge, huge interest in food provenance.
Yeah, there is interest. We know that, don't we? We've talked about that before. We know there's interest in food. There's a lot of interest in supporting British farmers at the moment. There are, of course, harvest festivals taking place all across the country at the moment. So there is that recognition and there is that, you know, willingness to celebrate and applaud farmers for what they do. So, yeah, if we could somehow tie that all in and square the circle or whatever the phrase is and get everybody recognising how important this is and using British food as much as possible.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast. The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You're listening to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. Welcome along wherever you're listening to us from. You can email us podcast@fwi.co.uk. And if you're in the UK itself, you can also message us by texting the word farm, followed by your message to 88440. An email this week from Hertfordshire farmer and former NFU Cereals chairman Andrew Watts, who says, podcast spot on again regarding the sustainable farming incentive and DEFRA. Hugh Louise, delays again to the SFI, the sustainable farming incentive. We said last week it now looks as though it won't reopen to applications before next April at the earliest. And Andrew Watts saying, we got our analysis spot on when we covered that story. Farmers holding their hands up in horror at having to wait so long.
Yes, I mean, horror is one word, and they're sort of almost resigned and used to this now. It's good, isn't it, that we're getting that news out, and interesting that people, you know, recognise that we're doing that. But yeah, the SFI, we don't really know, do we, what's going on or what it's going to look like. But we'll continue to wait and we'll continue to try and find out.
Yeah, look, it is, as we said last week, you've just got to, at the moment, budget on nothing at all. David Exwood made a very good point to me when we were talking at the old awards last week. And as he said, and I should have mentioned it, and I have mentioned it before, and we talked about it before. We've got to remember, though, okay, you've got the whole delay scenario to the system and the rollout of the system, and whether it's whether you need a new IT system or not, and whether that's just a red herring, just a delay. But of course, the other thing we've got to remember about is this cash split and how the cash is split between, say, SFI and higher tier and landscape options and rewilding and all the other wacky things that are going on that come out of that spend. And I think that's where You know, in the past, the farming organisations have been particularly effective at getting the cash in. And indeed, as we saw with some of the criticism around the SFI, when people oversubscribed to it and they shut it down instantly, as they did the other month, that there was no limiting on some of those options. So the sort of budget got carried away with. But it was testament to the fact that there was a fair bit of budget on the farming side. So we've got to hope, as well as the fact that we actually get some form of scheme that's useful, does help underpin our business resilience and transition and complement food production, that there's actually some cash there in the first place, or there's a decent slice of cash and it doesn't all go down the road to the NGOs and the landscape tree hugging brigade, which actually in the long term are generally worse in terms of value for money, in terms of delivery, than lots of very efficient small individual farm businesses doing stuff at really good price for the government.
Louise, in other news this week, fertiliser, the Agricultural Industries Confederation, asking farmers to order sooner rather than later.
Well, yes. I mean, it's not so much news, is it? It's farmers are being urged to secure their fertiliser supplies and to commit their requirements and what they need. You know what? I'm not sure that that's really what farmers want to hear at the moment. I mean, we know about the cash flow issues, don't we? So people will have bought some back in the summer, but they also will have thought, I'm not quite sure how much I want to spend at this stage. So I'm wondering if the fertiliser guys are just trying to get things moving rather than it being a genuine problem and that they're worried that they're going to be in short supply. Very happy to hear from those fertiliser guys if they want to contact the podcast, if that's wrong. But yeah, as you say, it's tough out there at the moment. So people aren't going to buy stuff too far ahead if they're really not sure that they can afford it.
Well, if you are a fertiliser guy or indeed a fertiliser girl and you'd like to get in touch with the Farmers Weekly podcast, podcast@fwi.co.uk. And if you're in the UK itself, you can message us by texting the word farm, followed by your message to 88440. Hugh, been up to anything interesting this week?
Thinking about that, perhaps should be buying fertiliser and become easy prey to scare story tactics. Now, I'm sure there's genuine concern there, but it does hark back to several years previously. We've had genuine concern from the fertiliser trade that you must get bought up. And I get, to a degree, I do get why they say that. It reminds me a bit of when I used to sell logs. I used to sell about 400 or 500 tons of logs a year, and I used to constantly remind my log customers to get in early and let's fill your log shed in July and not on the first Saturday of November when the first frost has happened, because it did. And this is where I do have sympathy for all of the people that have to trade this stuff. It used to get to the first frost. All the organised elderly customers would order their wood in April for the following Christmas. And then you would have this scenario where you got the first frost on, like, you know, the first Saturday of half term at the end of October. And then the phone would just melt down. And, or particularly if the first frost didn't happen till the end of November and people hadn't got any wood in, and it just got utterly unpleasant. And then by the time you got to Christmas, you just wanted to turn the phone off and hang it up, because you were never going to get all the product out to all the people. They were all going to hate you because you couldn't get there. And yeah, so I have a little bit of sympathy for them. But equally, I should imagine, given the cash flow state of most farm businesses at the moment, particularly on the arable sector, they are hardly going to be rushing in to buy vast quantities of it. Although we don't want to run out and get caught short.
Well, that's the fertiliser market sorted. And now for this week's commodity prices in association with the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board.
Thank you very much, Johan. Finished steer dead weight this week, 644.7. That's gone up 3.5p roughly on the week. The live weight, 369.1. That goes up about 4p on the week. Lamb, 678.3. That drops back about 4p. Live weight on the lambs, SQQ, 302.8. That's dropped back for just over 4p on the week. Pig price this week drops again, I'm afraid, 205.7. from 206.18 last week. And the arable markets, feed wheat, £164.20. That has gained nearly £2 on the week. Milling wheat, £177.60. That's gone up by about 6 quid. Feed barley gains all of 80p. Spots out this week at 146 dead, up from £145.20 last week. Oilseed rape, £397.50. That's dropped back just over a pound. Feed peas dropped right back, actually, £193.30. Back from £210.80 last week. £209.90 for feed beans. That's back about a pound on the week. Diesel's getting cheaper. That's good. 66.6. It's the diesel price of the devil. That's gone back about 2p on the week. So that's some good news.
Thank you, Hugh. And for trusted market data delivered straight to your inbox, visit the AHDB Preference Centre at ahdb.org.uk/market-data to sign up for and customise AHDB market emails.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast. The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, university and college fees can be horrendously expensive, but a helping hand is offering farm students more than £27,000 to help fund their studies. The John Innes Foundation bursary supports students undertaking a 3 or 4 year degree course in agriculture, crop production, or environmental science. It covers up to 4 years of course fees, mentoring, and help to get work experience. And joining us to explain how it all works is John Innes Foundation trustee Keith Norman. Keith, this is a really, really generous bursary. How did it come about?
You're right, it is. Every year, the John Innes Foundation donates about £1.2 million to support research, education, and public engagement in plant science, and facilitating those who are not from a farming background to help them gain a foothold into a career in our great industry is something I'm very passionate about. I had a great career in our industry, spanning over 40 years, and I wasn't from farming background, and I know too well how difficult it is to get to where you want to be.
So this is about encouraging non-farming youngsters into the industry then, Keith?
Yeah, so basically the bursary pays the course fees for any student who's taking a 3 or 4 year degree course in agriculture, specialising in crops rather than animals, and who is not from a farming background and whose family is financially disadvantaged.
And what's the application process like then?
It's quite straightforward, actually. There is a written application and a form that we get and we use to shortlist the candidates from. And then if selected, they will go through an online interview. So the application form, the easiest way is, if any of your listeners are interested, is to email me directly and I will ping them through a copy of that. My email address is very straightforward. It's keith@keithnorman.com.
That's keith@keithnorman.com. Thank you. And can students who've already started studying apply, or is this bursary for people who are just starting out?
Yes, it's a bit of both, actually. We normally start looking for candidates as of now, so most university students will have started already. But we have had instances where second and third year students, their situations have changed within their family who make them eligible in terms of financial need. And we have had one or two candidates that have come to us in that direction successfully. So, yes, it is open to all, really.
And the bursary doesn't just pay for course fees, does it?
No, because the opportunity actually enables the student who's successful to get mentoring throughout their time with us from myself. And also, I help to facilitate work experience opportunities for them as well during the university breaks, with placements offered at various organisations to get them some really good work experience.
Keith, thanks for joining us. That's Keith Norman. And if you'd like more information about applying for that bursary, you can email keith@keithnorman.com. And the closing date for applications is the 31st of October. Hugh, Louise, a great initiative. And like we said, a very generous bursary.
Well, it's fantastic, isn't it? I mean, tuition fees are now, they've gone up, haven't they, this year? They're £9,500 a year. And what they are doing is paying all of those. So that's across 3 or 4 years, because, you know, they might have a sandwich year in some of these courses. So, you know, £27,000 to £30,000. I mean, fantastic. No need for a student loan, hopefully. Just great. I mean, I think there are some criteria, aren't there? So I think that the lucky winner or person who gets awarded this has to come from a non-farming background. But how amazing, you know, to leave, to graduate from university, come out with no debt whatsoever. That's very, very unusual in these days.
And mentoring as well for the successful applicant and helping to get work placements too. Hugh, I know you've personal experience of this. You've seen what this bursary can achieve.
Well, it was one of the lovely students that worked for me a few years ago on when she was doing her MVQ course locally before she went on to university to study agriculture. She was fortunate enough to receive one of these John Innes bursaries, whole course bursaries. Funnily enough, I bumped into her the other day in the supermarket. It's fantastic for her. And she was bang on target for them because she was female and she wasn't from a farming background. And I do remember saying to her at the time when she left to go to university, I said, I'm not being in any way, shape or form misogynistic or anything like that. I said, but do bear in mind, you are not coming from a farming background and you are female. And half your course will be from a farming background and probably male. Make the most of it, and make the most of it she did. And she finished last year, actually. So it's a really, really amazing opportunity for anyone.
Yeah, an amazing opportunity. And if you do want more details, do email keith@keithnorman.com. Closing date for applications, the 31st of October. And that's about it for this episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast. We do hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've really enjoyed what you've heard, please do leave us a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with all the latest news, views and analysis of all the big stories affecting UK agriculture. But for now, until next week, I'm Johan Tusker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
Thank you for listening.